Yes,
it's gone.
Sweet.
Should we just start?
Yeah, sounds okay. Good to me.
All right, do you have, like, anything after this? That
I do right at 3:30. I have an interview that we're doing with, we're looking for a PR position. I don't know if you knew that.
No, I didn't.
We'll be bringing two candidates to campus more than likely in a few weeks. So
really?
Yeah, you'll, like, get emails about it and stuff.
That's good. Mm-hmm. We need more faculty, I'd say.
Always.
Okay. Oh, actually, first, maybe I'll just have you do this first. Okay. Awesome. All right, so... Okay, I'll just start off by saying... my name is Jenny Yu, and I'm currently interviewing Nicole Schultz, who is a faculty member in the Communication and Journalism Department. Okay, so let's start off with the easy stuff.
Sounds good.
All right, these are the background questions. What was the date and place of your birth?
6/11/80, and it was in St. Cloud, Minnesota.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's cool. I'm from Woodbury, so I'm around there.
Yep.
How do you designate your race?
White.
And your ancestry or ethnicity?
I am a hodgepodge of things. English, Irish, Dutch, Pennsylvania Dutch, German, Russian, I think is the list that my folks rattle off.
Wow, yep. That's a lot. And how many male or female siblings do you have?
One brother and one sister. My sister is a year and a half younger than I am, and our brother is 2 years younger than her.
So you're pretty close with your siblings?
Oh, yeah, very. Yep. My sister lives in town, and then my brother's here usually once a month. So in age and just friendship-wise.
Cool. What is your birth order in the family?
I'm the oldest child.
Yep. And what is the name and occupation of your partner or spouse, if you have one?
I have a boyfriend, John Arnold, and he is the head chef and kitchen manager at Fanny Hill Dinner Theater. We just went last night for our first dinner theater experience, so that was pretty awesome.
Really? So he works there, but you've never...
Worked there for like 2 years and he'd never eaten. I mean, he tasted the food when he was cooking, but never sat down to eat and never watched a performance.
How was it?
It was awesome. It was really cool. Yeah, I ate a ridiculous amount of food.
What was the performance?
It was, what was it? Tuna? Is it Tune Into Tuna?
Yeah, I saw advertisements
for it. Yep.
How many children do you have, if any, boys or girls?
No children. Nieces and nephews, and then I have a little dog.
Oh, what's the name of your dog?
Kima. She's 3. I've had her since I was doing my last year on my dissertation at Bowling Green State University.
What kind of dog?
Pomeranian.
Oh,
so
cute.
Some people don't call her a dog because she looks like a little rat sometimes, but she makes me laugh.
Cute. How many grandchildren? Okay, should we skip this one?
No grandchildren.
Where did you attend school and what degrees have you earned?
I got my undergraduate degree in organizational communication with a minor in mass comm from Monona State University. Then I went to Minnesota State University Mankato for 2 years where I got my master's in speech communication. And then I spent 3 years at Bowling Green State University where I got my dissertation in communication studies. Excuse me, I got my doctorate in communication studies and a graduate certificate in women's studies. And that was the first time I'd ever take a women's studies class was when I was working on my doctoral work.
We'll talk more about that later. Is there anything else about your general background that is important for me to know?
Not really. I was born in St. Cloud, Minnesota, but I grew up in Annandale, Minnesota, which is a little bit smaller town, about 2,000. So if I say St. Cloud, people maybe think it's a little bit bigger. And my youth experience was actually part of a much smaller community.
Okay. And then you moved out here after that? Or
then right after Annandale, I went straight to Winona. It was literally back-to-back-to-back between those three areas, those three schools.
Gotcha. Okay, now we'll get into the more in-depth stuff. Stories from childhood and adolescence. Describe your relationship with your parents and siblings when you were growing up.
It was interesting because if I look back, it was always healthy relationships with my parents when I was very young and even into junior high and whatnot. I think that as siblings, we had a lot of fun because we didn't really spend a lot of time with other kids like over the summers. We lived out in the country, and so we'd go across the street and play in the lake, bring the paddle boat out, do lots of stuff together, but we always kind of just quarreled and stuff. And that was all right. My sister and I did a lot of things together in high school because we were in dance line together and in marching band together, and her friends were people that I knew, and she was friends with my friends. We still kind of fought a lot, I think. I wasn't as inviting as I could have been growing up. And my brother, I didn't do a lot with socially. I mean, at home, we got along and everything, but didn't ever socialize or anything together until we were adults. And then I actually moved out of my parents' house when I was 17, and it could have significantly influenced my ability to go to college, because one parent didn't sign my FAFSA form, and the other parent I worked more closely with, and we kind of negotiated what parameters that person would sign it under. And so, yeah, it was a little bit rocky there when I was like around 17, 18, and then interestingly enough, when I moved to Winona, I really started to mend that relationship with my parents through email. And that was really weird. Email wasn't a big part of my life in high school, and I graduated in 1998, so it wasn't something that was used necessarily every day. But once I went to college, I found that I was able to communicate with my parents through email in a way that I wasn't comfortable doing over the phone or face-to-face. And so, I don't know, I was just surprised at how technology really helped us come together. And now, my family is definitely my closest. We get along, we'll spend at least 1 week in a month together. I'll go up to my sister's and hang out with her plethora of children. So,
so then growing up, what were the exact... Not, you don't have to go so in-depth, but the reasons that you and your parents probably weren't as close before college?
Excellent probing question. I think a lot of it had to do with, I thought, like, I just needed to prove that I was honest. I was making good decisions. I was doing well in school. I had a part-time job. And as long as I could demonstrate these things, that I would be awarded freedom and choices and a voice in a way that I hadn't been prior to being 16, 17. And when that freedom and that choice didn't come along with me demonstrating that good behavior, I think I started to retaliate by not being a good family member, by not communicating in a respectful manner, and so that just manifested itself into really bad things. And I've had many conversations with my parents as an adult since then, and especially my mom would always advocate that it doesn't matter how well you do, it's not about you, it's about the world around you, and understanding that you can plan accordingly and you can behave appropriately, but it's our job to protect you, and we can't get a phone call from somebody that says, is this your kid over on Highway 55? I need to know where you are, and I need to have some just governance over you as a child, because you are still a child. So,
yeah. So that was kind of the reason for being strict.
Mm-hmm. And my parents were always strict, which is a good thing, but it was very regimented. On the weekends, we would do household activities and tasks, clean out the garage, work in the car, whatever that was. But it was always, who are you going to work with today? It wasn't, what are we going to do today? What kind of event are we going to? It was, okay, it's Saturday. Are you going to work in the garage or are you going to work in the house? And so that really had a lot to do with kind of the nature of the house and even staying home from school. I have a perfect attendance clock that I had perfect attendance all the way through high school because, I don't know, if you weren't well enough to go to school, then you, I know, isn't that weird, dorky?
Yeah,
if you weren't well enough to go to school, then you needed to stay home and lay in bed and you needed to rest all day. So a lot of people would not go to school and then they would do something fun with the day off, and I didn't have fun at home laying in bed all day, so, a lot of that had to do with that, or my parents, if you did a job for them, they asked you to do something, you were supposed to go and do that and then come back and say, okay, well, what's next? And so I think that that type of communication was something that I thought I would get away from once I was demonstrating that I was capable of being an adult, even though I wasn't yet, or I thought I was capable. that's probably where a lot of that started.
Would you say your siblings had a better experience with your parents?
Yes, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that I think my sister and my brother, they worked at the same place, and they did things together in a more supportive manner that I didn't include my sister the way that she had included my brother. And so I think in part they had a better experience because they were willing to do things together and underneath my parents' parameters, regardless of whether or not they agreed with them, which is something I didn't do. So they were just more amenable and realistic about their expectations there.
So did you feel pretty good about moving out at 17 then, now that you look back, or would you change that?
Oh, I totally would have not wanted to move out. It was awful. Really, really awful. Like, they had to come and get me and say, it's time to come home, or you're going to go to the authorities. They're like, these are your options. Like, it was, I know, and knowing myself, I'm very confident and comfortable saying this over a decade later, but it was very embarrassing at the time, and I didn't know what to do and how to deal with it, so. Okay. They did the right thing. I very much believe that.
Where did you go? Just wondering.
Where did I go when I moved out? Yeah. I went to two different friends' houses. Women that I'm still friends with today in their weddings and stuff. So,
oh, that's cool.
And my parents were in communication with their parents as well. So it's not like I just took off and hid. It was another, I don't know, I was very open with my friends and their parents as well. So were my parents with their parents. So it wasn't like I was just running around saying bad things. They were good, supportive people that I were with that were in good contact and wanted to see our family reunited in that way too, which a lot of people don't have. So.
Yeah, that's cool. Was there any like religious background that maybe your parents were very strong about, or just really strong principles that they went by?
Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. Those were the three. We went to church growing up, went to a Lutheran-based church, and I was required to go through catechism. It was interesting because my dad said, you have a choice, and this is something the church is asking of you. And my mom said, you have a choice, but if you don't go to catechism and do well there, then you don't go to volleyball. So it wasn't really a choice. But I also appreciate that experience because I learned a lot about what religion is and to study religion. So I'm appreciative of that. But I don't think a lot of our core values necessarily came from the church. It was more don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. And they're not mutually exclusive categories. They overlap so much, and that's not acceptable, any behavior that's related to that.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Tell me about the community and neighborhood where you grew up.
Out in the country on a dirt road every way for 2 miles, an older community. So on our street that was probably about, we'll say 3/4 of a mile long, there were only 4 houses, and there are 5 houses, including ours, 4 other houses, and everybody was significantly older. Right next door to our family growing up, my grandma lived there, and so we would spend a lot of time with my grandma and with my grandpa. My grandpa died when I was 12. My grandma died last year. But, yeah, the neighborhood was very much people that were my grandparents' age, and so my dad did a lot of caretaking, checking up on, following up on with the other families. He was the one that did all their snow plowing. If somebody had come down and knocked down a mailbox, he was the person that put it back up for them, all that kind of stuff.
That's nice.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, was that, what city was that in?
That was Annandale, Minnesota. Okay. Technically Silver Creek, Minnesota, but all that's there is a post office and 2 churches.
Is it still like that now?
Now there's just the 2 churches. There's no post office. Okay. There's a bar also.
Okay. Describe how your family was or was not connected to the community and neighbor. I guess you kind of talked about that, but if you wanted to elaborate more.
Yeah, they're connected to our immediate neighbors, but there wasn't really any kind of connection to a greater community because where we went to school was 15 minutes away. Excuse me, Annandale, Minnesota, and it's my parents weren't members of any kind of communities or organizations or anything like that besides the places at which they worked, and then members of the church. As I got a little bit older, not necessarily when I was, like, a child, but when I was in junior high, high school, my mom started to join, like, a couple of clubs, people that would get together once a week or once a month, home extension type things. But, not a real strong connection to any kind of community organizations or even a town in specific.
Do you think maybe the place you grew up has to do with maybe your parents kind of securing you and kind of keeping you in this bubble?
Could be. I think it mostly has to do with my parents just like to be at home. And we lived in the country. Like, even to get to my high school was 15 minutes, which meant we were literally the first people on the bus and literally the last people off on the bus. And so that was an hour a day, 2 hours, or an hour each way, 2 hours a day that was spent on the bus. And I think it's just my parents liked being out in the country. They liked doing that thing. A big thing with growing up was we could be in sports during the school year, but in the summer, my mom was like, I'm not spending my summer running kids around. Like, that's time to be at home, to be outside, to enjoy things. And so some of that had to do more with, I think, our remote location. It was easier for my parents to manage that if we were way out in the country. And they liked that. They wanted that to be their family life.
And who had power and privilege in your community, and how did that affect you and your family?
I thought about that question a lot, and for me, when I think of in the community, I think of, like, my experience at school and growing up, and I think in terms of having power and privilege, very much white folks in the area. There were 2 families at all immediately above or below my grade or my siblings' age that weren't white, and that was 2 people that were adopted that were Korean and 2 or 3 people that were from a black family. Their parents were black, too, and other than that, everybody around us was white. Growing up, my parents had some friends that were homosexual that we didn't know that as children, but we started to know that into our adolescence. And all those things were things that I'd just taken for granted. They weren't really talked about. They were just, okay, this is so-and-so, and that's who they are. Or you just would see race. Not necessarily something that we ever discussed or tried to dismantle or anything. And then also the social class aspect would be the other area in which I would have seen power and privilege in the community. I was talking about how in the summer my mom's like, well, we're not running around and doing things except for marching band, because she liked the music program. But other than marching band, there weren't other things that we did. And so that really kind of limited access to certain circles that you had, information that you had, access to varsity sports, which can develop some really strong leadership or communication skills for people that are important. So maybe in that kind of way, people that were part of a household that were willing to support that, had money for it, had whatever other resources they need, that's the way I kind of experienced it in my adolescence and in my childhood.
Okay. Was it run by like a city council, or like what kind of, do you know, was it like a community board that kind of?
No, it was just more individual things that stratified that distribution of resources.
Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of what are the expectations of how somebody can achieve something. But no, it wasn't anything necessarily throughout the community. It was more just at the high school level, and I think that that's something institutional and systemic in nature. The thing was, I had 150 people in my graduating class, and so if I was limited in my ability to actually be able to play volleyball at a high school level or be involved in something, I couldn't imagine how that is also played out where people are in graduating classes of like 500 people. So I know it happens elsewhere. I don't think it's unique to my community, but I think it's more of a high school education system issue and limited resources and money to put into that kind of stuff, more so than any group of people in the community doing anything like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what values did you learn from your family and other people and institutions in the community?
I'd say very much the don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal bit is probably the biggest thing. It was just always driven home. And it wasn't even ever asked, like, are you lying? It's, nope, you don't lie. And even knowing secretly now, when I was growing up, there were times that I did. But my parents really believed that we didn't, because that's the way that we functioned as a family. Whether or not you're lying isn't the issue, because you don't. And so it was, now I should feel guilty for that, but I don't. I really understand like how that value was instilled in me, because it wasn't about whether or not you're going to choose to lie. It's you always live your life based on the assumption that other people aren't, and neither are you. And if you start there, I think you're living a little bit in a naive bubble, but at least then that was communicated to me in a way that was never questioned, and I was supported in my endeavors too, which made me likely more open and honest than I would have been if that wasn't the precedent set in the household, I think.
How do you think that kind of affects how maybe you'll raise your children someday?
I don't know if I'll have children.
Or maybe the way you are with your nieces?
Yeah, for sure there. I don't think that I'll do it the way that my parents did it, in terms of assuming that people aren't, because I know not every time somebody's lying, but I know people lie. So I think I'll be more motivated to approach something without telling somebody they're lying, but pull out the ways in which they are, so that we can get at the root of why do you feel the need to mask something that's true about yourself or what you've done or your behavior in order to save face for yourself or others. Like, how come you can't do that in a different way? That's probably the way that I'd talk about with my own children and or with nieces and nephews. And right now they're 1.5
wow.
and 5 and 7. So especially the 5-year-old, sometimes she'll know that she wasn't supposed to do something and she doesn't want to disappoint somebody else. You can see it in her face and the narrative that she gives afterwards, but still figuring out, okay, why did you do that? If you can't figure out why you did it now, how can you avoid doing it in the future? So you know you're going to get hot. I just caught you.
What occupations did your family pursue, or your parents pursue?
My mom was a Head Start teacher for years and years,
okay.
and now she's still working with the Head Start program, but it's a migrant program, and so it is part-time, it's like 9 months out of the year. And then my dad worked at an opportunity training center, which was a place where people with different developmental and physical disabilities would come and work, and they would put together pieces and parts. And so he did quality control, and he did kind of part assembly. So, for example, they did a lot of, like, Bible kits. And so if they got this bid and got this job, he would have to figure out, given the people that he had to work with, to actually put the kids together and their developmental and physical disabilities, how he could make it so they could do the job and that the company could still make money off the job so that these individuals would have employment. And so he developed how that would get done and then quality control in terms of time management and pieces and parts. So those are their two big careers.
They sound like really care-focused people based on their jobs. And mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really cool. What lessons did you learn from each parent?
My dad, I continuously still learn lessons from both of them, but I'd say biggest lessons from my dad have to do with people. And so one is that don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, but another is that when you're talking to people, I think that I get most of my communication from him, because when you're talking with people, it's not about what I think. It's not about what I think is right. It's not about what I know. It's about how I can work with somebody else to establish that and get them to understand that or agree with me. One thing that comes to mind is I would always use the phrase obviously or clearly, right? Like, obviously this. And he'd say, well, obvious to whom, Nicole? It's only obvious to you right now. And so to me, I think that my passion for communication really comes from him. And with my mom, she is the most even-keeled person I know. Just amazing how she really can look at a situation where somebody else will take something defensively or get upset or frustrated, and she just has an ability to look at it in more of a factual manner and say, okay, well, sometimes that's going to happen. What are you going to do about it? And to not let other people get under her skin to the extent that I think most of us do every day. She just really is somebody that's able to handle things that come her way in a calm and confident manner that I think I'm capable of doing on some level, but not to the extent of my personal life that she is.
How do mothers do that?
I know, amazing.
What role did education play in your life?
When I was like a child, or like adolescence kind of? Like not my higher education, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, to me, huge. Again, that perfect attendance thing, very important. But it wasn't just the education, it was the socialization that goes along with people, and I think that for me, associating going to school every day in high school and junior high with being able to interact with my friends and my classmates and everybody there, that really has long-term influenced my life because I believe in such collaborative learning. Like, I try to do minimal lectures in classes and really draw the experiences of students out in order for us to make sense of theories and assumptions. And so for me, equating education with socialization and that collaboration, I think had a long-lasting impact on my life. And I always was very dedicated to my education. I think I just want to make sure that I am well respected by other people. So it wasn't so much that I thought learning was important or that I was going to use the information, but I wanted to make sure that when a teacher talked to my parent or a teacher talked to a friend's parent or I saw them out in the community, that they thought I was a good person and I did good work.
Do you feel that you took that along with you throughout high school as well as higher education?
Yes, definitely. And I think I have that right now. And I talk about that in small group communication, for example. We were just talking yesterday about this theory where there's always two things going on in a group. There's at least two things. There's that idea of there's always relationship management, and then there's the task at hand. And so for me, I tend to prioritize the task at hand in my work, when I'm serving on committees, when I'm meeting with my colleagues. And I don't necessarily know that everyone I work with puts the task first. They want to make sure we're a good cohesive department because we're going to work together long term. Yep. And so I think for me, I still very much want other people to look at me as a professional and be impressed with my work and want to continue to work with me. And for me, I do that through tasks more so than relationship with management. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that's the most effective, but that's the way I've carried that idea of the importance of education and other people looking at me favorably into my work environment, saying I need to produce quality work and be consistent in that.
All right, well, let's see. Okay, give an example of how gender, race, ethnicity, and social class were important in building your understandings of yourself and society. That's the mouthful.
All right, so how gender, race, ethnicity, and social class were important in building my understandings. Again, I think it's that social class piece for me, because we were a family, like my mom taught at Head Start, and we also were a lower middle class family. And so there were times, depending on the health of my parents and what we were going through, whether or not we were on any kind of assistance programs, whether or not we had reduced lunches, things of that nature. So I think that really helped me understand a little bit more of what society is. And again, with my mom's keen ability to just explain situations and address them, there was always times when money was tight, but it was just something that was communicated as, okay, these are decisions that we're making as a family, and we're not going to be doing this. And it just became, that's the way you do things. And so for me, that presence of social class helped me understand myself a little bit better and society, because my parents spoke about it in a transparent manner, I think.
Do you think that transparency is probably a good thing then, or?
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so. Just explaining why things are the way they are. And again, that has to do maybe with my mom's profession, because she worked for Wright County Community Action for the Head Start. And so that was a community level assistance program. So lots of different programs were run through that office. And so she would also just talk about other challenges that families face in our community. That it's not like I knew the families that she was talking about, mm-hmm. but just the existence of that through her profession and her accounts of her profession, the families that she worked with. Maybe some of the cognitive abilities of people of lower class status that she worked with that qualified for these programs that she worked with also helped me understand that everybody isn't just like me or like my friends who maybe have more money. And so that helped me be a little bit more self-aware.
So she kind of instilled that social difference, the value of that mm-hmm. in you.
Yeah, very much so.
What memories do you have of being discriminated against or seeing others who are victims of discrimination?
I think it was more in my adolescent and high school age, more of a social class issue again, and it had to do with kind of cliques and who was maybe considered popular or not popular, that type of discrimination. But besides maybe like somebody making smart comments, there wasn't overt discrimination that I witnessed a lot in high school or at the junior high level or growing up or anything. More so it's systemic or institutional issues in terms of having access to certain opportunities. But, and I'm not saying it didn't happen, I'm just saying I wasn't aware of it when I was younger. It's not something that I saw mm-hmm. in my friends or in my family on a regular basis or at school.
Can you elaborate more about the systematic mm-hmm. discrimination?
Yeah, I think more so when I think back, I still can't remember specific instances where I saw one person use hate speech against another person. Doesn't mean that it wasn't made in a third-party reference mm-hmm. to homosexuals or to black people in general, but I didn't see people being overtly discriminated against in front of me like that. But now that I think back, I can think of situations where people didn't have access to, for example, to be in band. And when there's so much research that suggests to be in choir, to mm-hmm. be in band, there are very important analytical skills that are developed cognitively at certain ages. Well, if in my high school, or my elementary school and middle school, that started at fifth grade. But you have to have family that are willing to purchase you an instrument and then also make sure that you can get to school before hours for certain lessons. And just some people didn't have access to that. They couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that's where I see systemic or institutional decisions being made that continue to reproduce limited access mm-hmm. for some families that I grew up with.
What did you learn from experience? Well, I guess kind of covered that one too. Mm-hmm. So, describe any efforts you witnessed or participated in to confront discrimination. What tactics or strategies were used? You said you didn't really witness that much.
Yeah, and for me, just to make sense of the systemic and institutional stuff, I think not to necessarily end it, but to help me process and understand it. Again, it just comes back to my parents engaging in dialogue. Mm-hmm. If I would come home and say something about somebody in school that, okay, we're in fifth grade and so-and-so is pregnant. I know that people can get pregnant in fifth grade, but my parents also knew this person wasn't likely pregnant, that this mm-hmm. is some kind of rumor. And to really, from a young age, start to socialize me to say, well, who said that and why did they say it and did you ask the person, and just try to help me understand that the way that you see things or hear things might not always be as black and white as they are. So why is this person saying that? And then trying to get at, is it because they aren't popular? Is it because they don't have money, the right clothes? So they would eventually get to that point, but they didn't say it. They drew it out of me. So that's kind of the ways in which I saw my parents combating that discrimination based on social class that I was experiencing, was trying to help me process that.
You said your parents knew a same-sex couple, right?
Yeah.
And they were very accepting of it, from what it sounds like?
Yeah, my dad, his best friend from growing up, Lee, and Brian were both homosexuals, and my dad didn't know it for years and years. Like, and so this was before my time. Mm-hmm. And my grandma, one day my dad, I don't remember how he found out or something, they had a conversation, and so my dad told my grandma, because he was close to the whole family, not just my dad, the friend was, and then my grandma's like, well, yeah, I knew that. And so it's just funny that my dad was friends with somebody for years who, for some reason, didn't disclose that information, but again, that was in the 60s and the 70s, so there's a lot of politics going on there for them growing up in a smaller town together. And then for once that is made, my dad's like, well, I didn't know that, like, I don't know. And then for him just to say, okay, well, then just told my mom, and she's like, yep, I already could tell that, I already knew that, like, there was just things that she had perceived. And yeah, and my parents again just spoke openly about, okay, yep, this is Brian and this is Lee, and they live together. And I don't think my parents necessarily used words like partner, domestic partner, or a thing like that. I don't even know that they labeled it as boyfriend, but they acknowledged the cohabitation and the relationship there. And it's something that we were exposed to. And yeah, these are our friends, and that's what they do.
Cool. Okay, what memories of your childhood continue to make a difference in your life?
I have one specific example that really, I think, has made a real big impact on my life. And we used to have family meetings. Mm-hmm. And so at the family meeting, just like most households would do, like, one person talks at a time. But my parents encouraged us to bring our own agenda items. Sounds really dorky. This is maybe like once a month. And it wasn't for like 18 years. I don't know when I think we stopped once we were kind of into mm-hmm. high school. Because I remember them more at like the junior high level. I don't even think at grade school, because my brother would have been like, what, in first grade? Like, but they really tried to give us as kids and adolescents, like, voice. Okay, well, we're going to have a meeting, things that need to be talked about, whether that's how things are getting done, how we're communicating, plans. Sometimes it was just planning, what are we going to do for a summer vacation or something. But we were encouraged to bring our own agenda items, so things we did or didn't like, negotiating job schedules, like I said, you know, when you're done with the job, you go and then you come back. My parents were very, very strict about the job lists. You get home from school, you shouldn't be eating food, you shouldn't be watching television, you should be doing your jobs. We'll be home. We were home by ourselves, I think, for maybe like 50 minutes or something after we got off the bus. And so when we got home, you're supposed to do the jobs. It should take you 50 minutes to do the jobs. If you didn't spend 15 minutes doing it, then you probably didn't do it right. If I come home and one of the things on the list isn't done and it was on your list, then that means you probably didn't do any of them right. So you need to go back and redo them all. And so, like, for example, we had a dog, and she would stay in the basement. And sometimes she'd go to the bathroom on the floor. She was hooked up. So you have to scrub the floor. And then I also had to bring out the bathroom garbage. Well, if I didn't think it was full enough, so I just didn't bring it out, then, and this was every day, and if I didn't do that, then my parents were like, well, if you didn't do the garbage, how do I know you scrubbed the floor? So you need to go scrub the floor again. And it sounds awful when I say it like that, but they were very literal about, okay, these are the expectations that we have for you, and you're going to meet them. And so if you didn't meet them the first time around, let's try it again. Sometimes it wasn't said that pleasantly, but for me, those are some childhood memories, that idea of, we mean it when we say that this is an expectation of you. So if you chose not to do it when we weren't home on your own, then now it's time that you could be having fun, but now you have to meet the expectation. And so I think that influences me a lot with work. I'll go to some collaborations with colleagues who don't have their work done. And I don't understand that. I'm like, but you picked the date it was due, and you picked what we were doing for a project. How do you not have it done? Like, but I understand everybody didn't grow up with parents that were talking to them like that. But then at the same time, my parents' amazing ability to, like, try and empower us with a voice via, like, those family meetings and saying, well, you have opinions about our family, too. What are they? So that you have space to talk about it. Just interesting, that kind of polar opposites there.
You use that in your classroom at all?
I do, especially the idea of having a voice and having family meetings, that you need to carve out space in your interpersonal and small group and organizational relationships. You don't necessarily have to call it a family meeting, but if you don't build it in, why is somebody going to come to you with criticism or ideas? I don't necessarily use the, if you haven't met it, then come back, which I probably should. It would help students maybe understand more so when I say it's due at this time, or when I say I need you to include this element, like, I mean you need to do it. So I do a lot of revise and resubmits in class, which maybe that's my version of what my parents did with the job list. It's like, okay, well, you didn't do it right, you have to do it again.
Okay, what significant historical events do you recall most clearly from your childhood, and how have they affected you throughout your lifetime?
I thought about this question. I don't really have much for historical events. And I think a lot of that has to do with I didn't start becoming aware of the political events that are going on in society or in the world at all until quite recently, actually. I don't think I ever watched news or sought out news online or anything during my undergrad degree, unless it was a required assignment. Same thing with my master's. I really just focused on my studies then, because it took me a while to get good at college. Like, I was on academic probation and stuff for a while. And so I was really hard-pressed to think of historical events that I remember. I could tell you dates of things that happened, but I don't have any kind of connotation associated with them. I don't know why. It just wasn't something that was important or made transparently important to me with my family. But my dad always, right now, is always referencing things that are going on and things that he saw. So I don't know why that was such a value for him or why it is such a value for him now to be able to have those conversation pieces. But it wasn't ever anything that I highlighted or that we highlighted as a family growing up.
Where were you during 9/11?
That, excellent. Okay, so that was when I was in college, and my dad is kind of funny because he knows the exact number. I don't remember what it is. Mm-hmm. But he'll reference the number of times that I called him that day. It was like 7 or 8 or something. And I was recruiting for Winona State University, and I was in the admissions office. And my roommate calls me just bawling, and I don't understand why she's crying. And so when I was in the office, I worked in this mail room with a fellow intern, and we didn't do mail. That's just where we got to. That's where our office was in this mail room. And so they had a TV that they brought in, and so we were able to watch some of that. But yeah, it was very difficult for me to process that, and I really depended on my parents, particularly my dad, with that. And I don't necessarily know that 9/11 itself influenced my life, but it was something that opened up for me the idea that things that I don't care about, that I don't pay attention to in terms of politics or world affairs, do have a direct impact or potential to have a direct impact on me and the people around me.
Why do you think you called your dad and talked to him?
Because it really just didn't make sense for me why there would be crimes like that, why there would be terrorism, how people would make those choices, because it's nothing that I ever had to deal with. And since I kind of distanced myself from really the idea of what war or an attack is, to know people that knew people that were there, to have that kind of visual display on a television that wasn't something that I know somebody experienced decades ago or is going on in a place halfway across the world that I've never really thought of or heard of, to say that's something that happened locally on a national level was something that I didn't know how to process, I think.
Kind of sounds like an awakening or something.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Looking back at your childhood, would you have anticipated that you would become a feminist later in life?
Now when I look back, yes. But nobody in my family used that kind of language or anything like that. Yep. No, but looking back, I'm like, okay, what, especially with some of these questions you're asking, what were the things that my parents instilled in me, or what were the things that I challenged or questioned about? Yeah, I definitely can see where some of those seeds were laying or whatever at a very young age. But my parents, I don't think, would identify them as such, and they for sure didn't when I was growing up.
But they sound like humanitarian people.
Yep.
Who,
yeah.
Sort of feminist ideals.
Mm-hmm.
What else would you like to share about your childhood experiences? Anything in particular?
Oh, I had another thing with the kind of the family meetings.
Mm-hmm.
I said that I had these friends that I was very close with in high school, and two of them I had lived with during the time frame when I was away from home. There were 6 to 8 of us, depending on which year in high school we were at, but very close knit friends, and we had gatherings that we called bitch fests, which probably isn't the best language, but I didn't know that at the time. And literally that was a time for us to get together to have open conversations about what we thought were going well in our relationships, and then really what kind of interpersonal dynamics aren't working within our small group that need to be addressed. Because anytime you have 6 or 8 friends that are friends in high school, some people are closer than other people, but if we are dedicated as a whole group of being all of us, part of the conversations that we acknowledged we needed to have were difficult ones, and so it'd be a slumber party, and we would just say, okay, what's your deal? And I don't, looking back, I think that's so weird, because I don't do that with anybody now. I mean, I'll check in with my significant other every once in a while, but to carve out space to say, what's not working for you, and how do we need to address that, I thought that that was something really profound for a group of 14, 15, 16-year-old girls to intentionally do. Just interesting.
Whose idea was that?
I don't even know whose it was. I'm guessing that we probably, there's one woman's house that we always went to. I'm guessing one time it just turned into a heated discussion, mm-hmm. and then we called it that, because we were pretty good about then diffusing and laughing after situations. I'm guessing it was an idea. I think that my friend Tess had labeled it such, and so we just went with that next time somebody had something that they wanted to bring up, or next time we were going to be together, that would be a portion of our gathering.
Okay. All right. Here's the interesting stuff. Okay. Crafting feminist identities. Describe your educational path after high school.
Went to Winona for those 4 years, and like I said, my academic studies were very, very poor. I should have been kicked out multiple times, but because we could take summer classes, and whether or not your GPA was below whatever, 2.0, if you were taking summer classes, then if you get your GPA back up by the end of the summer, then you'd be okay. So I took a lot of summer classes, retaking things that I had taken a stab at during the year or didn't do well in. It wasn't until about my sophomore year that I just understood that, okay, I need to learn how to study. I need to put in time. And then once I got that down, great in my major classes, found my home department in communication, started getting really focused on my internship, things like that. But I never thought about grad school. But a friend of mine, Anne, so I don't know if I wanted, you wanted me.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I don't know if I brought... Yeah, I did bring a picture of her. But one of the things was my friend Anne, she was in classes with me, and so I was just telling her what I wanted to do for a job, and mm-hmm. she said that I should try out for a commencement speaker. Mm-hmm. I don't think I brought a picture of her, but I should try out for a commencement speaker in college. And so I did that, and that's me when I was in college. I don't know. And so I tried out for that, and she'd also kind of in the same sentiment said that I should... look into this thing at Mankato. She's like, they give you some money and you can teach. Because I was just heartbroken because I didn't get this traveling trainer job that I wanted. I'd gone through 3 interviews and they were only hiring one person and they didn't pick me. Which was fine, but I needed to start paying back these student loans. Mm-hmm. And so I applied for this teaching gig or whatever, and that's what ended up bringing me to Mankato. And so I went to Mankato for 2 years, and then I went to Bowling Green State University in Ohio for my doctorate. And I learned about that place because my mentor, Kristen Trinan, at Mankato, she had gone to school with somebody that was teaching over there. And he did a lot of like critical pedagogy stuff. And I just was interested in studying some with him in a place that valued his work.
What did you study at that school again?
Critical pedagogy.
That's what you studied.
Okay. I studied communication studies, okay. But that's what my interest was okay. when I got over there.
Okay.
Yep.
That's cool. Your occupational path.
Yeah, so after I got done at Bowling Green State University, I came here. And so my last year at Bowling Green State University, I was the director or the assistant director of teaching assistants. So there were 40 teaching assistants, and so I coordinated their work and their efforts into teaching assignments and evaluations, things of that nature. And so that whole year I spent applying for jobs for the next year. That's how long a job search is in academia. And I'd interviewed at 3 institutions, and this was by far my first choice, especially after my interview. I was just very impressed, good fit, and then I got hired.
Nice.
Yep. So directly after school, I didn't have any outside professional experience or anything like that betweenhand.
That's cool. Did you see yourself in academia again?
I did after my PhD, but between my master's and my PhD, I didn't know. Because when I went to get my master's, I thought for sure I'm just buying myself 2 more years of being a college student, and then I need to get a job. Mm-hmm. Once I was there for a year, then I said, I really like this teaching thing. What do I have to do to have full-time employment teaching at one institution after I'm done? And it was, I had to go get a PhD. I had a lot of friends that taught at the community college level, but they would have to piecemeal things together in Minnesota to get full-time status. And so I just decided if teaching is what I wanted to do and I wanted to work in higher education as a professor, like, I had to go to school for more years.
When and how were you awakened to social inequalities based on gender, race, social class, sexual orientation, and other layers of identity?
I would say it was when I was in Mankato. I understand that I experienced these things beforehand, but I wasn't awakened. I wasn't aware. I didn't analyze them in a way that I felt I was productive in doing so. I'm sure I did assignments in college, and I'm sure that my professors were productive in trying to get me to see those things, but I didn't identify them. I didn't understand until I took this class with Kristen Trinan. It was called Critical Pedagogy. And have you seen this book, Paulo Freire, Pedagogy of the Oppressed?
No, I've never seen it.
She had a couple of things, and her idea of critical pedagogy and anti-racist pedagogy is that you should question why the knowledge exists that does. And it's much more than the fact that somebody studied it, it's that somebody had access to studying it. And the ways in which we communicate socially constructs these hierarchies. And so even though she, at the time, had never verbally identified herself as a feminist, she has since now, since we've been working together and been friends for a long time. But at that time, taking that class with her and saying, what is critical pedagogy and what kind of values do students bring to the classroom? This book and that class with her was the first time I ever really understood what that was or thought it was something worth talking about and pursuing a career around.
Did that kind of affect how you study women's studies?
For sure, because I hadn't done anything in women's studies when I met her yet, but I didn't know then, and now I do, I mean years later, that critical pedagogy and feminist pedagogy, there's a lot of overlap there. And so, yeah, this was kind of my orientation to feminism, which is interesting because there's no word surrounding feminism directly in this text or in that class, which I think was useful at the time because I don't know how I would have reacted to the idea of feminism if that word were attached to it. I'm not saying it would have been bad, but I'm saying I didn't have that experience.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, people are like, when I first had my feminist class, my first one ever, I was like, I'm not a feminist, just so all, you know, I just have similar beliefs. And then by the end of it, I was like, I'll use that F word, I guess. Okay. What memories do you have of your first encounters with the feminists or the subject of feminism?
And I had a lot of people that I worked with that were feminists, but maybe because I wasn't a feminist, I didn't identify as that. But when I look back now, I know that those people are, and we've talked about it since, and or I can identify people that maybe don't identify as feminists, but they are. And for me, the first time I was overtly introduced to it was this very good friend of mine, Andrea Davis. She was going to get her women's studies grad certificate at Bowling Green, and she said, you know what, I'm really just double dipping because we have to have a cognate or an out of our home department kind of area of expertise, like a minor. And so she's like, I can get a certificate and check that off my list at my home department, so why not do that in case I want to use it somewhere later in my job? And she openly identified as a lesbian and as a feminist, things neither of which at that time that I identified with. And so that was kind of my first encounter. I was like, all right, I could maybe look into that. And I looked at the types of classes I could teach or I could take for that, and I could take classes that would help me learn more about what it's like to be a woman in higher education and what it's like to teach from a critical perspective in higher education. So I think I got into feminism more to develop myself as a professional, not necessarily to learn the feminist ideals. So then I took this other class that was our Intro to Fem Theory class, and we used this book, Judith Lorber's Gender Inequality book, and I use this in my Women in the Mass Media class now, just parts of it, because it talks about all these different types of feminisms. And so that first introduction for me was this idea that feminism is multifaceted and you can identify how you want. And so for me that was very empowering right at the beginning. And now what I try to do with feminism is really share with students that you can identify or not identify. These are frameworks for analysis to try and ease people into it that are not necessarily comfortable identifying as such.
Sort of an intro to it all and not scare them away. Let's see. What experiences, social movements, or events, or people were important in shaping you as a feminist?
Andrea Davis, definitely. I think a lot of the people with which I surrounded myself at Bowling Green State University, because these were people that were marginalized from a majority, either by race, sexual orientation, class. that spoke openly about their personal experiences and how ideals of feminism resonated with them, but in a very transparent, like, scholarly or theoretical manner, because we were all going to school for our doctorates, or people were professors there, and so we were having that kind of intellectually challenging conversations, even if we were just at a bar playing pool. I mean, that's kind of what we did, and so that really helped me kind of understand some things, and it really did shape the way that I think of feminism. However, I did find difficulty in trying to take those conversations and then all of a sudden go and talk to my family or friends outside of those circles. Mm-hmm. So I try to be very careful with students about that and say, okay, we're spending 3 hours a week together in class learning these ideas, exploring the extent to which we agree with them, how we think they're useful, not useful. If you leave this class and use the same language and think you can explain to your roommate or to your parent in 4 minutes what you spent 5 weeks learning, they're not going to be on the same page as you necessarily. So remember, you always have to be very patient about how you got to where you are and share that with people if you want them to understand what it is you're about to offer or say. Very, very difficult for me to do. But I try to share with students that it's a struggle and something that they have to acknowledge if they want to pull any of the feminist theories or ideas or observations or analyses that we're making in class and use that in their personal or professional life.
And that leads up to our second one, or our 23rd one, I mean. What resistance, if any, did you face from people you cared about when you became a feminist?
A lot. And I think that's challenging for me. And it doesn't mean that I faced resistance in terms of people cutting me off, mm-hmm. but I think, especially in my own personal life with family, that if I say something, it's different than if anybody else says something, because I am now a feminist. Not like I turned feminist or anything, but people know that I have that opinion. So I have to be very careful about how I say things if my goal is for them to receive them well. Because I can say one thing and say, I did my piece, I said what needed to be said there based on the observation or the way somebody was talking about something, but that communication side of me says, yeah, but that's not effective. Like, if I didn't reach the people I'm talking with and I want them to understand why I don't want them to use certain language around me, or when we're talking to my nieces, why it's important to not necessarily reference the 1.5-year-old Maverick if he smiles at a 40-year-old woman in the store and you say, oh, he really likes the girls, you're socializing them to think that he likes girls. That's an inappropriate relationship to begin with, but people don't see that. They just hear me making a big deal out of nothing. Yeah. So I really need to be strategic about when and how I say that. And so for me, those are the types of resistance that I have when people write it off as, okay, well, that's the women's studies in you, or, oh, yeah, the rolling of the eyes, the flippant hand that goes along with that nonverbally. I didn't know to expect that when I started bringing these issues up. And so I also tell students, too, theories are awesome. But if you go into your personal life and you cite a theorist or a model, people think that you're trying to one-up them and be snot. So you have to think about what's your goal in sharing this with somebody and how can you do that so they receive it effectively. And then they actually take the input or the idea or whatever it is. And so that's one place I found a lot of resistance there. And then also with my dad, it's not that he is resistant to me, but he won't identify as a feminist. And he is so feminist. And so it's really frustrating for me to have conversations with him because there's the language barrier, because he acknowledges that he can't release those connotations away from what other people think feminism is. And so kind of like back in the day when he would say, it's only obvious to you, Nicole, he'll say, but that's only feminism to you. And so when I say feminism, for me, is just the basic idea of equity based on all different identities. He said, no, that's not what it says on Google. That doesn't matter, Dad, I'm right. But I'm not there yet with him for him to view feminism the way that I do, and thus he doesn't use that language as part of his identity. So for me, that's a form of resistance.
How does he identify then?
He'll say, yes, I believe in equality, and I understand the difference between equality and equity, and I think these things are important, and the observations you're talking about he doesn't necessarily say observations or consequences, but he'll say, the things that you see, yeah, that those are definitely things that people have to deal with, and that people's behaviors do have certain results. But he won't use a feminist, necessarily, framework for that. Says that that's something different because other people will not listen to what he has to say if he identifies as feminist, because to other people, he said it's all about the populace is his word that he uses. He said it's about what the populace thinks. I can't say that one color is another color if the populace thinks that's a green scarf. Like, I have to talk about it like it's a green scarf, otherwise people aren't going to listen to me. And so I think that's where he's at with that.
What do you think about, like, if you're trying to make change or trying to make known what feminism is or to correct someone for saying something very derogatory, would you say you have to work within the system as a feminist, or would that be against the ideals of feminism?
Very difficult. And I try to share this with students, too. For example, somebody today was talking about how they wanted to do some kind of self-defense focus for a course project. I said it's important to look into feminist ideals on that topic. And I'm like, you'll find a variety of examples. Some people say it's very important because violence against women is a very real segment of life. Other people say if you live your life as the assumption that women should expect violence from others, then you're succumbing to that ideology and that's not okay. And so for me, I think that I struggle with the idea of not wanting to let go of the feminist language because I feel empowered that we have that language. But at the same time, I think that to some extent, you need to let the communication aspect prioritize there. Because if you look at that basic transactional model of communication, that idea of there's a sender and there's a receiver, and somebody can send that message, which is usually multifaceted because you have the nonverbal, you have the verbal, you have the context of society or the relationship with whom you're speaking, all that stuff. But if you are going through and if the end result is for you to have some kind of shared meaning, that somebody agrees or at least understands what you said, I think you have to use other people's language. And so I definitely tailor that when I'm speaking to people, either by prefacing things or operationalizing or defining the terms I use so people understand how and why I'm using them, or taking on kind of a different persona altogether and leaving some of that at the door, knowing that I'm bringing the thoughts and ideas I have. The language doesn't matter. I don't have to use that. Even though to me it's very important. I could be more effective without it sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Describe the process you went through as you decided to identify as a feminist.
I think at first I started to say I align with feminist ideals. I very much eased into that. And then I started to maybe come full circle when I was here and I started to teach the women's studies, the cross-listed women in the mass media class that I kind of inherited. Somebody else had created it here. They needed somebody to fill in that class. They saw I had the certificate, so I said I was going to say yes to anything they asked me. Okay, wanted to make sure I started on a good foot, so anything they asked me, I would have said yes to. Just so happens it was a really good fit. And when I started teaching that class, we talked about feminism. So in my teaching philosophy statement for that class, I say I approach it from a feminist epistemological or pedagogical perspective, but I didn't say that in my other classes. And now I'm to a point where I am the same person in all of these classes, so why am I not identifying as that? And so for me, that kind of process started with first identified where I align with feminist ideals, and then I turned into I am a feminist in my personal life, and then I kind of evolved into the idea that, okay, I bring these feminist ideals and my personal beliefs into all of these classrooms and into all of my professional contexts. Why am I not identifying as such? And so I started to do that, but I still do it in a kind of a justified manner. Like, I'll make sure that there's some kind of source citation references, or I'm using current or language from current literature to help support my argument. So I still feel like I need to defend and justify feminism as an approach to anything, but I'm doing it. Maybe I'll get to a point where I don't feel the need to do that anymore.
Someday. So when exactly was, like, the moment that you were like, oh, I am a feminist?
Mm-hmm. I don't know that I had one. No, I think I just made connections between critical pedagogy and feminist pedagogy, and I started to say, oh, if I'm doing these things that I think are critical pedagogy and they overlap with feminist pedagogy, then I must be this also. So I don't think it was necessarily a point in that, but I think it was professionally is where I came to that realization. It wasn't in my personal life as an activist or anything.
Yeah. You just realize, oh, it's similar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Feminism has been described as a river with many tributaries. contributaries. In other words, although feminists are united by some common beliefs, they understand and express those beliefs differently. How do you describe the tributary of feminism that best fits your beliefs?
I'll go back to this Lorber text, and so she identifies lots of different types of feminisms, and this is just her take on it. I always tell students, like, if you read a different book, you might find different feminisms, and that's just fine. But she talks about a couple of different feminisms that I align with very well, and one is the idea of social constructionist feminism, just that everything is socially constructed. And I think that aligns so well with my home discipline of communication, and that home discipline of communication is so important in my personal life that the social construction of realities is very important to me. And so that feminism or that tributary is something that serves me well. And I think another one is standpoint feminism. Just that idea that there's intersectionality where you can't just be one point. That idea of standpoint being, I am always all of my identities. I can't just experience anything as a woman. I can't just experience something as a professor. That I'm all these things at the same time. And that the knowledge that exists, it's a product of social interaction, and it's a product of limited access or access to resources. So I think those two things are the lenses that I use to really kind of understand who I am as a feminist and to interpret the world.
Do you feel, I feel like maybe in a way that's kind of your way of being an activist, almost like just the way you talk about access to things.
Mm-hmm.
How do you create more access or things like that?
And I don't even know that it's that I create more access for other people, but I think when I'm interacting with people at work and in my personal life, that I acknowledge when there isn't access to something. If somebody else makes a comment about the way that somebody behaves in a group or the way that a coworker works with them, I'm like, you know, they learned that from somewhere. There aren't appropriate consequences for their behavior in order to motivate them to change it, or there aren't adequate rewards in there. And so that social construction of what led them to make that choice. And so sometimes rewards and consequences come in the form of resources that somebody is situated in that experience. And so I try to make that more openly addressed when I'm talking with people, especially if somebody seems a little bit more closed-minded or just wants to judge another person's behavior or stance on something.
Have people acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What meaning does the feminist statement, "the personal is political," mean for you?
It means a great deal. I love that statement because as much as we try to segment our lives in order to make sense of them, and I understand the basic communication perception process that I see stimuli, then I interpret it, and then I assign meaning. And I like to do that because mentally my brain wants to put everything in a box. I get that. But that's not the way it works. When I'm in the classroom, I am not another person. What I'm doing there, that's very much who I am. It's helping me frame and reframe my own personal beliefs all the time. And so that personal is political. Everything that I'm doing at work is related to who I am when I'm not identifying my primary role as professor. Same thing outside of work, that the things that I'm doing in my personal life have a direct influence on my professional life. And that both of those identities that people definitely want to separate and people identify, I spend 40 hours a week as this person and I spend the rest of the time as this person, that those are inextricably linked to the political overall. And that can mean politics in specific, that because of what I experience at work in conjunction with what I experience in my personal life has an influence on what policy I think should exist, how I think that policy should be structured and enforced. But it also has to do with how I influence other people's political views. And so I think that they are so inextricably linked, and when people try to talk about them as separate identities or as separate entities, that they're just trying to make sense of their world, and they're failing to acknowledge the ways in which one sphere really influences another sphere.
How do you define power?
I define power as privilege. I don't necessarily think that they're synonyms, but for somebody to have power, they are likely situated in a way that they have privilege, in a way that other people in that situation don't. So, and that can be title, it could be access to things, it could be the dominant ideology of society and where that person, either their beliefs or their profession or their demographics, where they fit in that socially constructed hierarchy.
How do you feel that you have privilege or not have privilege?
Good. I have a lot of privilege. I was just talking to somebody the other day because I was making a phone call, and my boyfriend was next to me, and I had said partner on the phone, and he just smiled. Because sometimes he does that when I say partner over boyfriend, and I guess I change. I guess I haven't used roommate yet. That might be a funny one. And so he's like, how come you do that sometimes and other times you don't? And I said, you know, I think I started using the phrase partner to help advocate for legitimacy of a homosexual's right to acknowledge a relationship with somebody in a way that isn't heteronormative by relating to boyfriend and girlfriend. And also in a way that when I was in Bowling Green, I had many gay colleagues and friends. And so to bring that legitimacy to what they said, and also in social circles, if they wanted to reference their significant other without revealing to a student or another colleague that they were gay, if other people know I'm heterosexual and I say partner, that may to some extent provide them space to do that. But at the same time, then it's saying it's not necessarily a good privilege to have, and at the same time I shouldn't expect that I want to carve out space so that gay people don't look gay. But in certain political situations, I believed that my colleagues needed that kind of space as well. But that's from my privileged perspective as a heterosexual. And so definitely as a heterosexual, as a white person, I also think that age can be something in there. So depending on what the situation is, I think that I have privilege based on age, and in other situations, I think that I don't.
What type of situations?
I think with students, a lot of times, I don't necessarily have the privilege of the assumption of a level of credibility because I do use more feminist teaching styles. I am younger. I prioritize formal or professionalism on a different scale than the majority of my department, since they're all at least 10 years my senior. So that perspective from a professional aspect, I think, but also just the idea of my title, I think, gives me a lot of privilege. There are ways in which people will interact with me over the phone and over email, and I've seen people at this institution and elsewhere communicate with me. And then I've seen documentation of the way they communicated with a student, and I cannot believe that. And it's happened with me, too. There was a woman last semester. We were just leaving our end of the semester class, and we had a potluck in the room when we were debriefing on the semester and everything. And she came in before our allotted time was done. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. We were kind of done cleaning up, but I'm literally walking around making sure that all the last little paper plates and everything are picked up. We have a garbage can in there. She comes in and literally starts swearing and walking through the room. Who did this? Who did this? And so I tried to maintain my composure, but I said, it's ours. There's still the next exam isn't scheduled for 15 minutes, and we still have the room for 5, so I'm picking it up. She was too busy kind of just throwing a fit or being upset or expressing her opinions to hear me, and I wasn't going to yell or get defensive back or anything. And so she turned, "Are you talking?" she said to me, and I just couldn't believe that a university professor, anyone here, was talking to another university professor here. And then I just told my chair about it just so that she knew if anybody came back that I didn't want to have a bad reputation for the department, but it was me. And I acknowledge I shouldn't have food in Hibbert, but I'm going to have food in Hibbert. And so she said, you know what, I think my chair had said that she was fairly confident that that professor probably thought I was a student. And my chair right away said, and that doesn't matter either. But yeah, I do understand that I have privilege. People will talk to students in a way that's not appropriate, and they wouldn't do that to me if they knew that I was a professor. And that's a great privilege to have. And that carries outside the university walls, where people assume that somebody is smarter or more professional or something because of their job title sometimes.
That's interesting. How have you negotiated and balanced your identity as a feminist with constraining cultural expectations for femininity or masculinity?
I don't know that I have. I think that I perform a lot of the expectations for me that exist in dominant society for femininity, but part of that has to do with I have, again, the privilege of performing feminist behaviors in the classroom or in my interactions with family or friends that are collaborative in nature, supportive, because my privilege comes from I'm able to align those feminist practices with femininity that people expect from me, so I'm not violating any norms there. Now, I am violating the norm of what education should be, because a lot of people, especially if they're at the sophomore or junior level, are likely in the cognitive process of believing that education is dissemination. Somebody's teaching me, they're telling me, and that's not where I'm at, especially as a feminist. So I violate that feminine or masculine expectation that education should be masculine in nature and be dissemination of knowledge with my feminist values. There's one way in which I negotiate and balance that, and I acknowledge it, I guess. I don't change it that much. But I do need to acknowledge that my colleagues have the masculine expectation. So I just got my performance review letter today, for example. You get one every year from your senior faculty. And it said that one person had commended me for using more engaged learning techniques. And this came after some examples from student evals of what students had said about wanting more lecture. And then it said, however, two DPC members encourage the faculty member to use lecture more consistently as it is something expected by students. What they didn't realize they were saying there is the masculine expectation of higher education as an institution. And so I have to acknowledge it and I have to balance it because I need to pay my mortgage more so than I need to perform feminist behaviors in my day-to-day life at this point in time. But I don't know that I've necessarily, in my individual, like my individual dress, my individual choices, those types of decisions, I don't know that I've negotiated that. I think I reproduce expectations that are stratified for men and women in a way that isn't healthy for people. Because it alleviates cognitive dissonance and makes me feel like that's I'm performing something or I'm not violating something that other people expect of me. Thus, I maintain some kind of positive persona in their perception.
That's interesting because I know a professor, Pamela Foreman. Okay, she, you know the word, I just realized you used the word dissemination. She makes it a point to not use that word. She says, like, she uses, ovinate or something.
Yes, ovulate, or ovulation,
something like that. It's really funny and nice. I heard her say it once, and I was like, what?
And that's interesting, too, being in women's studies, learning the language that people use and don't use, because if disseminate comes from semen and the dissemination of semen of men, then what is it, etically? Whatever, linguistically in history. And then another thing that you'll notice with some women's studies professors is if there's a PowerPoint up or if there's a handout, they won't say bullet, they'll say seed, because bullet is inextricably related to violence and it's not something we want to perpetuate. And so it's interesting the choices that you make with your language, too.
What have been the greatest challenges you have faced as a feminist?
I would say bringing things up with my family, especially my brothers-in-laws. We're all very close. And so 4th of July, like my immediate family and our significant others and children will spend time at his in-laws. Also, a couple times a year, we'll get together just for fun, whatever it is, or some of them will come out here. Some of his cousin-in-laws will come out here. And they are very comfortable telling racist and sexist jokes. The dad of that family, very comfortable being an openly racist person, typically monitors himself in front of other people, but sometimes doesn't. And when other people participate in that, one of the greatest challenges I've faced is twofold. One is addressing the situation right away. I used to be in a situation like that and I didn't know what to do, so I just didn't do anything. And if they didn't say anything right away, then if I were to bring it up later, it would be a big deal or something, or I would just never bring it up. So that's one thing, that when I see things, acknowledging them. But two, focusing on acknowledging them in a way that they'll be well received. I don't want to just say something because I thought it needed to be said. I want to say something because maybe I can curb this person's belief or behavior just a little bit, or at least the nephew down the hall doesn't hear it. I mean, whatever my outcome is, but I need to think more consciously about, okay, what do I want the outcome of this interaction to be, since I believe I'm responsible for having some kind of reaction.
What is your typical response when you do over here?
Depends on what it is. I just remember this one time I was at my parents' house in the garage, and I don't remember what my brother's father-in-law had said, but he said something, and no one said anything. It was, like, referred to a black person in using an overtly derogatory phrase. And I just couldn't believe that nobody said anything. But I didn't say anything. Nobody laughed or encouraged the behavior, but nobody said anything. And so I've just gotten better at it. I'll try to do it with humor, and I'll try to say why I think it's important for somebody to curb that behavior. You know, it's not about you. It's about somebody else. And it's not that I think it's important. It's that you don't realize who else is around you or who you might offend or who you're talking to, and then, like, help somebody realize why that might be important to them. But I think more times than not, all that's happening is those people don't say those things around me anymore. They're still saying them, I believe.
Okay, we've been here for an hour and 14, so I don't know when exactly you have to go.
Do you want to just stop here, and then we can do the other, is like half of it?
Yeah, there's only a page and a half left.
Yeah, do you just want to schedule another time to do the last part?
Is that okay?
Yeah, no, that's totally awesome. Okay. Yeah, they are amazing questions. And you're so good at probing, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Very impressive, yep.
Okay. All right, should